The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly
prohibited.
We're
going to start up again for our afternoon panels. And for the benefit of those who are watching on the now live webcast, I just want to remind everyone that we did go dark for the live portion of the webcast during the luncheon time. But we continued the webcast, so those of you watching us not live, you will have seen continuous coverage from the luncheon to this third panel. And we also had coverage of the luncheon on C-SPAN. We're going to now follow up on what I said this morning about the basic concept of the program. Now that you've heard about strong recommendations for different things, and with a lot of enthusiasm and passion expressed by panels one and panel two, these four gentlemen and this lady here, their job, in effect, is to say, well, enthusiasm and passion is a good thing, but you know, you got to be realistic at the same time and talk about how things really are, both within the government, the executive branch, I should say, and on Capitol Hill at the beginning of a new presidential administration, and that you have to be realistic. So when you exercise your judgment in filling out those questionnaires, the survey questionnaires during our fourth panel, you'll then be able to be perhaps more realistic than the passion and enthusiasm of panels one and two would have led you to be. And for this panel, we're very pleased that we have a moderator who probably is known to just about all of you. He's someone who is really the grand old man of FOIA, because he goes back to the 1960s, believe it or not, and so much so that he received the Robert Vaughn FOIA Legend Award from the Collaboration on Government Secrecy right here in this room on FOIA Day last year. And Tom Suspin is going to take over and handle this panel very well and live up to his name, I know, as a FOIA legend indeed. Thank you very much for doing this, Tom.
Thank you. I'll stand up for quick introductions, and they will be quick because we have some outstanding and experienced panelists that I want to hear from. I want some dialogue among them. I want questions from the floor, and so you don't need to hear much from me. In order of their speaking, but not necessarily as in the earlier panels, the order in which they are sitting, we're going to start with Lydia Grigsby, who is on the far right end, Chief Counsel for Privacy and Information of the Senate Committee on the Judiciary. That translates into Patrick Leahy's top staff person on the very set of issues that engages us today. It's not just the experience she brings to that job from having been in the U.S. Attorney's Office, the Justice Department, and private law practice, but Lydia was a principal staff person for the 2007 Open Government Act, and that will, I think, be a badge for her, just as I still occasionally get reminded that my day in the sunshine and freedom of information was the 1974 amendments to the Freedom of Information Act. Lydia is going to start us out, and I've asked her to bring reality down to earth from a congressional perspective of, new administration, new Congress, relatively recent law, where do we go from here? Frank Reeder is going to follow. He's to my immediate right, and Frank has an afternoon commitment. We may break for some questions if you have them after Frank's comments so that he can then depart. Sends his apologies early on for not being able to stay around for the rest of the panel, but that was a condition on which he accepted, and we were so delighted to have someone with Frank's experience, OMB, White House, the other House, that is the House of Representatives, and most recently, President-elect Obama's transition team. Frank will be able to give us as close to the ground as we can hope for about the forces that will be shaping executive branch policymaking in the access to information arena. And then we turn to an insider who's inside the executive branch, the National Security Council, Special Advisor to the President on National Security Issues, Bill Leary, and end up with Bill Leonard, who many of us know for years. He served over 30 years as Director of the Information Security Oversight Office, and did groundbreaking work there in acting as the keeper of the secrets, and being, I think, through the years, very unbureaucratic in the way in which he approached the declassification process. But with all of that combined experience in government, I think we will, as Dan put it, see where the aspirations of the morning meet the realities of the afternoon, and where all of the good, hard work and important recommendations that many of the organizations assembled that we heard from this morning, the ground on which they fall when they hit the executive branch and Congress in the real world. So with that, Lydia, we'll start with you.
Okay. Good afternoon. I hope you can hear me. I'm somewhat suffering from a cold, but it's great to be with you all again this year and to be a part of such an exciting activity like this. I want to thank Dan Metcalf for inviting me and the American University Washington College of Law for also inviting me to be here today. I guess I would say that this January, as we begin a new year, it's a really, really exciting time here in Washington because we are also starting a new Congress that's coming in with a lot of energy and excitement. And I think particularly for us in Congress, it's very pleasing to have also a new president that has already demonstrated an openness and willingness to move our government towards more openness and transparency. So although I'm going to certainly talk about some of the more pragmatic aspects of moving forward in open government, it is a time to be optimistic, and I am optimistic as I come to you today about some of the things I think we can do and accomplish in the next 12 months, I think, to help make our government more open and transparent. One of the first things that I think is very important to understand is that while we're very excited about the new opportunity for openness, and my job maybe has become a little bit more fun, it's not an easy job, and it hasn't gotten much easier because there's a lot of work we still need to do to restore transparency in our government. And I'm fortunate to work for a chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee who cares very deeply about that issue, and we have a very busy agenda already laid out for the next few months on that front, which I wanted to talk a little bit about today to give you some ideas of some of the things that I think will be challenges and opportunities for us over the next year. The first thing I think that will be important is, Tom mentioned earlier, the reforms to FOIA that were enacted back in 2007, and some of you may be very familiar with them. One thing you may not know is many of those reforms actually did not become effective until just this past December. So we're going to spend a lot of time this year with the first real opportunity to look at whether those reforms are making a difference, how our federal government is implementing them, and whether they're actually being effective. So a big part of our job in the Congress will be oversight, and we'll be doing that on a very bipartisan basis with Senator Cornyn, who's also a big champion of FOIA, and a number of other members in both houses of Congress. One of the key areas, and I noticed in the materials that were handed out, this was actually mentioned as one of the recommendations you all are considering, is the role of what we call the FOIA Ombudsman and the Office of Government Information Services. That was really a key aspect of the reforms that Chairman Leahy and others worked so hard to implement back in 2007. And unfortunately, we had a very kind of reality moment in the Congress where we realized there was a lot of resistance in the past administration to those changes, and there was a lot of effort by many members of Congress to push the administration to go ahead and follow through on what it intended with the legislation. Now that we have a new administration and a signal from our president of a new commitment to openness, that's one of the top areas where I think you will see the Congress really trying to reach out and to work with the administration to get OGIS up and running, to get funding in place, and also, again, to hear from government agencies and FOIA requesters about how that process is working to try to make FOIA work a little bit better. So I hope that as you all are thinking of priorities, you will think about the Office of Government Information Services and help us in the effort to really get that up and running. I think it'll be greatly beneficial to everyone. In addition to oversight, there's obviously legislation. And the Open Government Act was really just the tip of the iceberg in terms of what we need to do. FOIA has been around for more than four decades, and it's a great law, and it's done a lot to keep our government open. But like many things, it's not perfect. And so I think there is still a need to look at other ways to make FOIA more responsive to people, to bring in ideas about technology and other tools that are available to us now to make the government more open. And I think you will see this year Chairman Leahy in particular working across the aisle on other legislation to address issues related to FOIA. One I'll mention briefly has to do with legislation itself and what Congress does often. Oftentimes Congress will legislate in an area and will include in legislation an exemption to keep certain information out of FOIA, B3 exemptions, as most of you know. And that certainly has its place, but what we found, particularly in the last 6 years or so, oftentimes that happens in the dark. And you never want to have legislation where you don't even know what you're voting on. And many times, even members of Congress have no idea that there are actually provisions in big, humongous bills that actually create exemptions to FOIA. And my boss really believes if you're talking about FOIA and open government law, you should certainly be transparent about whatever you're doing with FOIA. So one thing we're going to do is we're going to try to encourage the Congress to enact legislation that would make that process more transparent so that members of Congress know and the public knows when these exemptions are coming up, and then we can work together to really debate these issues openly. I think that's a pretty common sense thing that certainly can and should be done. It's an issue that's been pressed in the Congress at least for the last, I think, 5 or 6 years, even predating my time on the committee, and unfortunately it has not become the law of the land yet. So that's one area where I think you're going to see a common sense approach to transparency that can make a huge difference in terms of FOIA requesters and making our government more open. The last thing I'll mention is, since we're talking about information policy and the Obama administration, there certainly is a great role for parts of government outside of Congress to play. And I wanted to highlight briefly just two areas where I think the administration can take the lead and certainly Congress can be a helpful partner in pushing openness. And that has to do with improving how we overview FOIA and how we implement FOIA. One idea that Senator Leahy has had is looking at the possibility of some type of a commission or organization to look more holistically at FOIA and how it's been performing over the past four decades. This is something where certainly legislation can play a role, but maybe having some group of people who can look at it more in a long-term approach may be more helpful in terms of seeing what's working and what's not working. The other area that's going to be very important is, of course, the role of the Department of Justice. And I think we've all probably learned about the Ashcroft memo and the recent executive order, which begins the process of undoing the Ashcroft memo. For those of you that may have followed the confirmation process for the Attorney General designee, Chairman Leahy asked specifically about efforts to restore the presumption of disclosure and to roll back the Ashcroft memo. And the Attorney General designee has indicated the willingness to do just that. I think that's terrific, and that is just the beginning of work that will have to be done at the Department of Justice in terms of its FOIA policy, in terms of how they litigate FOIA cases, in terms of what guidance is given to federal agencies on FOIA matters to, again, restore the idea of openness. So I think it is an area where certainly Congress has a role. It's very important to have an executive branch that also shares the ideals of openness, and we are very excited about working together to make the process work better for the American people. I look forward to the discussion later. Thank you.
Let me just ask for one footnote, since you didn't take up your full allotment of time. Senator Leahy in the past had introduced legislation to open Congress itself more. At one point, it was sort of to apply freedom of information to the Congress. I never particularly got on board that idea, but it does seem to me that there are certain areas of congressional activities. There's been legislation on CRS reports, various things. Senator Leahy, as a member of the Smithsonian Board, was involved in getting them by discretion, not through legislative directive, to assume a more open stance. Can you look beyond the executive branch and share any of your thinking about whether it's government-sponsored organizations, government corporations, Congress, the courts? What are your thoughts in those areas?
Sure, and I think that's an excellent point, because transparency certainly goes beyond just the executive branch. One thing that Senator Leahy has always been very active in is encouraging the use of technology to make the government more open. So I think we just mentioned CRS reports. He's been supportive of legislation and policies within the Congress to start making information that Congress generates more accessible and more open to the public. He also supported legislation, for example, dealing with government contracts and information like that, and making that publicly available online. I think you will continue to see that. An interesting issue actually has arisen with the Smithsonian and other types of organizations that aren't part of the executive branch or aren't executive branch agencies. And Senator Leahy, who's also a member of the Board of Regents, worked very closely with the Smithsonian and with FOIA requester groups for the past 6 months or so to try to work to make that institution more open. And they actually announced a new disclosure policy earlier in the week that is much more consistent with FOIA, and I think we'll begin the process of opening up that institution. So yes, there are lots of things that we can do. Senator Leahy certainly has been one that's always been out front on these issues, and I think that will continue. And that's why events like this are so important. We get feedback from all of you about areas where we can work to improve government openness and transparency.
Great. Thank you. Frank?
Okay. I want to thank Dan and Tom for inviting me to be on the panel and renew the apology in advance that I do have to cut and run. As I told my co-panelists, it won't be in reaction to anything they've said, although at least that's my cover story. As we also discussed, we have the much coveted after lunch spot, which is always, you know, when you're on a panel or speaking, you try to get the moderator to give you the after lunch spot because you know that folks are going to be really energized and excited about hearing you. And I'm sure I'm feeling the love in the room now. Two qualifiers. Happy birthday. My esteemed colleague Dan Scholar is sitting here, who's just celebrated a seminal birthday, and happy birthday, Dan. The two qualifiers. One, I come here with no official standing but full First Amendment rights, which is one of the things you get restored when you leave a public payroll. So I speak freely, but please understand I speak in the first person singular, so anything I say cannot and should not be attributed to any organizations like the current administration with which I've been working. The other piece is, as you can imagine from the things that I've done, that I am an unabashed partisan and supporter of this administration, so that should help you position my remarks. That said, a sort of a general comment that should be obvious but is worth thinking about. Transitions are when campaigns either collide or converge with governance. And the challenge, of course, facing this administration is taking a very ambitious agenda and turning it into a reality in a world that is far more complex than the, and I will say this again in the first person, the somewhat simplistic homilies we hear in campaign rhetoric on either side. And so the challenge that faces the Obama administration, as it would have in a McCain administration, is making that happen. That said, having lived through I went back and did a count, 8 presidential transitions from one perspective or another, this was more a convergence than a collision. There was remarkable harmony. It was a stunning transition from several perspectives. And I think there are 4 worth thinking about. One is these are unusual times. We haven't had a transition in wartime, certainly since 1933, not one in the economic conditions that the Obama administration faces. Second, we have an extraordinarily well-prepared campaign. We were planning this transition from the immediately after the convention. We were ready to roll on November 5th. We were the stealth transition because, of course, in our form of government, candidates are supposed to pretend that they're not going to be elected, so they wake up on the 5th of November saying, oh, my gosh, what do I do now? Of course, you know that's not the case, and, in fact, these folks were very well prepared. Third, there was a level of excitement about what was happening, bipartisan. Some of my friends on the other side of the aisle said, we supported the other candidate, but we're excited about the possibilities here. So there's a sense of goodwill, a sense of excitement that I certainly haven't seen since 1960 or the 60-61. And finally, and not enough has been written about this, extraordinary cooperation from the Bush administration. The president The former president went out on November 5th and said in the Rose Garden, I've instructed my folks to cooperate, and by gosh, they did. And we on the transition team had exceptional access to staff at every level. That said, let's get to the subject at hand. I look at openness as a continuum from access, meaning you give me what I ask you to, preferably cheerfully, through transparency, and again, giving the previous administration its due. The previous administration was the first one to publish statements of administration policy on its website. So it got the fact that you tell people what you're doing. Unfortunately, they did it always after the fact. That is, this is what we have decided to do, and then we fully disclose what it is. There were some small exceptions to that. But for the most part, the Bush administration did use technology to become more transparent. What I think will distinguish the Obama agenda from the current from previous administrations of both parties is moving not just from full and open access and transparency to civic engagement, actually engaging the polity, and I use that term advisedly, not citizens, not stakeholders, but the polity, everybody, in the process of the decisions. And you can see that, and let me give you some evidence of the basis for that, believing that this is more than just campaign rhetoric. One, look at then-Senator Obama's legislative agenda. One of his major accomplishments was was openness legislation that resulted in spending.gov, letting the taxpayers know where their money went. Second, in his September 22nd speech, he laid out a rather ambitious agenda, including everything from inviting public comment on legislation that has been enrolled, that has been passed by both members of both houses of Congress before the president signs it, and I'll come back to that in a minute. There's a very ambitious agenda. I would argue that participation, that civic engagement, that is getting beyond transparency, is in the president's DNA. This is not an add-on. This is not a weld-on. The transition itself was conducted in an extraordinarily open way. We were under direction from day one, and Podesta, in a memo to each of us on the team, I think it was on the 5th or 6th of November, and repeatedly thereafter were reminded that, one, we were to be accessible to everyone. That is, we were to be in active listening mode, and we were to go out, we were to reach out. I started calling folks in the areas for which I was responsible. They were shocked. That had never happened before. Transition teams, you know, the usual mode that all of us were in when, in transition is, whom do I find whom I can talk to sell my agenda? And we were under directive to go out and find those folks. But second, we were also then directed to make sure that when we were having meetings with folks outside of the administration, the fact of those meetings was to be posted. And we were told that any document that we received was to be posted on what was then the change.gov website so that the public could see what we were seeing and we could actually elicit public comment on what we were looking at. So literally the public had the opportunity to look over the shoulders of those of us who were helping prepare the new administration. So, in a way that blew me away, the transition walked the talk, and it was absolutely stunning. I will tell you, as I've been telling many of my friends, it looked better on the inside even than it appeared from the outside. We have, of course, the January 21 memo, and perhaps even more importantly, and I'm sure those in this room picked it up, in the conversation about the stimulus program, the president has been saying, and I will publish and let you see where the money is going. There is a website, recovery.gov. That is not in techie terms vaporware. Work has been going on that for almost 6 weeks. They are ready to roll when the Congress enacts legislation so that the public can see where the money is going. In contrast to what happened with at least the first tranche of the TARP money, the $700 billion bailout money. And there will be similar efforts to make sure that the public understands where the money is going with the remainder of the recovery money. So the Obama agenda is not just vaporware, it's not just campaign rhetoric, Real stuff is happening. A couple of things to look for. One is privacy is and will continue to be a terribly important issue, especially with respect to one of the major thrusts of the, since we're talking broadly about the information policy agenda, the health IT initiative. The administration understands, I believe, that unless it deals with the privacy question, the willingness of providers and the public to engage actively in a technology initiative won't be constrained by money or technology. It'll be constrained by public perceptions. And so there's a real commitment to work with the committees of the Congress, Ways and Means and Finance in particular, to address the privacy concerns about health IT. And then two other areas. One is another area to watch is the role of the agencies. The January 21 memo was written the way it was, and I can tell you, and I don't think this reveals any great secret, the first draft was about 10 pages long, and then it became apparent that, gee, maybe you shouldn't develop openness procedures behind closed doors and lay them on the world. Perhaps the right way to do that is through an open process, which is why there's a 120-day provision for the Chief Technology Officer and OMB to develop procedures. But there's also, and this goes back to the September 22nd campaign speech, a commitment that the agencies will be more open, that it's not just a question of opening the White House, it's a question of sending the message to the administration's new appointees that there's an expectation that they will engage the public in their deliberative processes. And finally, there's the question of the applicability of the Federal Records Act and the Presidential Records Act. Again, first-person singular statement. I have nobody in the administration deputized me to say this. I would contend that the previous administration offered up some rather bizarre interpretations of the applicability of certain laws governing records, particularly things like the assertion that the Office of Administration, which I headed once upon a time, was no longer an agency subject to Title V of the Federal Records Act. But this was just to make sure that Patrice was still in them. My expectation is that you will see a revisiting of, even though not everything there will be immediately accessible, certainly revisiting of the question of the responsibility to preserve those records for disclosure in an appropriate manner and time. With that, I'll give back the balance of the 8 hours that I was allocated and turn it back to Tom.
Just a short follow-up on that, not about what you said, but about what you didn't say. Those of us who attended the morning session and follow these issues realize that there was a big piece of the entire system called the classification system that hasn't yet been even whispered about by the incoming administration. Is that because things are in preparation and we should wait for a little later disclosure, or has that proved to be too hot a topic? Or would you have to kill us if you told us?
The short answer is I don't know anything for which I would be killed for disclosing. So the short answer is my answer is more speculative than based on knowledge.
Speculate with us.
And my speculation is that the alternatives you pose are not mutually exclusive. That is, that a fair amount of work has been done, but I suspect this is not the first issue that they would want to tackle, because it is, if not the third rail, close to the third rail, in the sense that it will be a little tougher to deal with. Dealing with Guantanamo and stem cells on days one and two was probably enough.
Well, the speakers who follow you are going to actually tell us how this can be done, so that was sort of a setup for that. Does anyone else have a question for Frank, because he is going to have to leave in the next few minutes? Patrice definitely gets to ask a question.
And why am I surprised?
Surprising all of us. Patrice McDermott.
I'm wondering, as you were on the transition team and were on the agents going out to the agencies, mm-hmm. what you saw in the agencies as their embrace of and their inclination and ability to implement these new directives.
Well, let me again qualify that with a little bit
right,
of
know,
sort
yeah.
of transition 101. The way this transition was conducted, and I think for the sake of good order, not for the sake of control, there was a series of agency review teams,
right.
and I served on the OMB team and had the management piece of the OMB team, and I served on the White House team since I had spent a little time there on the operational side, and was adjunct to a policy team called the Technology Innovation and Government Reform team, which had the lead for things like the transparency agenda and the performance agenda, two things that were priorities in the campaign. So my answer, I'm not sure I can generalize about the readiness of the agencies writ broad.
Right, right.
I can generalize about the willingness of the folks with whom I dealt, and their, and I saw no pushback at all, except that, and let's take spending.gov as an example, that the practical reality of saying we're going to let you know where the money goes is a little bit different from the broad policy commitment. So this is where
it assumes that they know where the money's going.
Exactly. And further, we have this there's little complexity in our constitutional system that, you know, perhaps we ought to rectify, but right now we have a federal system.
Right.
And if you look, for example, at Recovery Act money or the stimulus, a substantial chunk of that's going to be dispersed through the states.
Right.
So literally knowing where the money goes is not as simple as assuring that, you know, the Department of Education or the Department of Transportation knows the entities to which it has given grants. So in that sense, I think there was a healthy conversation about what is practical as opposed to anything that I would characterize as ideological or bureaucratic resistance.
Good. One more question for Frank.
Hi, Max Kakis from Federal News Radio. Mr. Reeder, I'm kind of curious. A lot has been made so far from people in the Web 2.0 community, all the folks who are for openness and for a lot more citizen interaction, about how WhiteHouse.gov, the new WhiteHouse.gov, isn't quite what Change.gov was. And I was wondering, do you have any perspectives to offer? I realize you're not speaking for the administration anymore. But do you have any insights to offer us on where WhiteHouse.gov is going to be going in that respect?
Well, I mean, and it's a great question, and it's a wonderful example of the, if you will, the collision or convergence of campaigns and governance. One, and we saw it when the email went down on Wednesday, and I was so glad I was not there anymore. Now, there are some times when you really want to be a spectator and not a participant. And that was one of them. The infrastructure in the White House is not at the level of the infrastructure that the campaign was being able to marshal. That said, the White House is dealing with a slightly more complicated problem than just getting a candidate elected. So that is challenge number one. Challenge number two, and we saw it with that little blip on the BlackBerry, is the that the 18 acres, as we snobs on the inside refer to it, is subject to some other constraints and legitimate constraints and requirements, like a requirement to preserve records and other things that properly limit the ability to be as agile as one might want to be. So there was a great deal of focus, you know, as early as I can recall, on how you make WhiteHouse.gov enabled as change.gov, and I promise you they're working really hard on that. But those two constraints, the requirement to be much more disciplined in record keeping, and records, in record preservation, and the technology platform is pretty good, better than we thought it would be, but not up to supporting the kind of Web 2.0 functionality that we saw in the campaign. I would be willing to bet a substantial sum that you will see radical changes even over the next 6 to 9 months. They're serious about civic engagement.
Thank you.
I was going to cut it off after that, but Professor Liu, you get to ask one question, and then we'll thank Frank properly.
I'm a visiting scholar from China. I'm here visiting in Washington College of Law, American University. So I'd like to ask a question, which is actually mentioned by Ms. Sharon Franklin this morning about the inner internal transparency within the government agencies. So could you give a short comment on this topic, and do you think it has any relationship to the a kind of reallocation of the powers of government agencies, and what kind of difficulties the government might meet? Thank you.
Well, you know, whether we let a terrific question, and again, I'm engaging in speculation at this point. Like it or not, we have acted in sort of what I, as a student of the Soviet Union in the 50s, came to know as democratic centralism. We pretended, you know, we made all our decisions behind closed doors, and then we went out and announced them. That transparency has to change the nature of power. I mean, in many ways, and I think the president understood this. He understood it when in his campaign, when his remarks at Grant Park on at the victory rally, he invited a diversity of voices. You know, we have a very complex form of government. It's got to be, if anything, while the president, not only in the way he has named his appointees, but also in the processes he's setting up, is probably shifting some power away from the White House. It almost has to happen that way, because there will be far more access points to the system than there are currently. By the way, I'm delighted that you're here. I'm reminded of an incident 8 years ago, 8 years and 3 months ago, on the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, when I was having dinner with a delegation from your country, trying to explain the Electoral College to them, little knowing, of course, that we wouldn't know the results of the election until about 6 weeks later. So you are here in
exciting
time.
We don't have any laws or regulations on government transparency at that time, 8 years ago. I mean,
thank you. I'm sorry. Thank you very much, Frank. Let's thank Frank properly. Appreciate that. And move on to Bill Leary, who will definitely give us a view from the inside.
Also, I hope you'll forgive me if I follow the instructions that Dan gave me when he asked me to participate, which were that my role here is to rain on your parade, to bring you back to earth after the euphoria of spending almost a full day discussing the wonderful new memoranda orders from President Obama and dreaming about what more may be coming. I think I can do that simply enough by reminding you of a few truisms about the federal bureaucracy and how it works or doesn't. That will surprise no one here, I'm sure. I do so with two caveats. Number one, I think it's absolutely right for everyone here, openness advocates everywhere, to be very hopeful about the policies and practices of this new administration. It is going to be a big difference. I will merely caution you not to expect too many more big changes too soon. Second, whatever I say here, as Frank emphasized, is entirely speculative and represents my personal opinion. I'm not speaking on behalf of the administration. I'm not speaking on behalf of the NSC. Okay, now for a few of the bureaucratic realities that will quickly assert themselves. First, this administration has already announced, as you all well know and have discussed this morning, has already announced three very important initiatives to promote a greater openness in government. And I suspect that there may be a tendency in some quarters to think that we've already fulfilled our obligations in this area. Don't keep coming back asking for more. It's time for us to get down to real work, to doing our real jobs. rather than these less important tasks that you want us to focus on. Secondly, most of the people who will need to approve further initiatives regarding the area that I have some knowledge of, regarding classification and declassification policy, have yet to assume office. And those few who have are extremely busy with other matters. And even when those positions have been filled, these issues, I am reasonably confident in saying, based on too many years of experience, these issues will never be a very high priority for most top policymakers in government. Third, any substantive changes in classification and declassification policy will require interagency coordination. Indeed, that kind of interagency coordination, I think, is even more likely at the beginning of an administration than later. New policymakers are particularly reluctant to make too many dramatic specific changes unless they are assured that the broad interagency community that has responsibility for the particular issue agrees with their, with the change that's being promoted. And of course, interagency coordination is a euphemism, or can be, for delay and resistance to meaningful change. I needn't remind you that the, again, in the field of classification and declassification policy, at least, I needn't remind you that some, probably many of the changes that have been discussed in recent months will be resisted by the entrenched bureaucracy. all of which I think means that the advocates of change need to be patient and need to stay focused on the highest priorities. The questionnaire that Dan keeps reminding us to take seriously and fill out is particularly important, I think. Because needless to say, not all the things on that list have any prospect of getting enacted. Some of them do. It depends upon what the highest priorities are. So let me, in that spirit, close by noting my highest priorities. Again, these are my personal priorities, not necessarily shared by the new administration. Number one is establishing a national declassification center at the National Archives that will bring together agency reviewers to perform collaborative declassification review. I'm sure that many of you here have heard about this concept, which has been discussed ever since the Moynihan Commission, if not prior to that, but which has, I think, a real prospect of being established now. There are a lot of initiatives converging, not least of which is the fact that President Obama spoke briefly and positively about the idea during the campaign. Second priority for me is ensuring that the Information Security Oversight Office, ISOO, has the authority and resources that it needs to provide meaningful oversight of the security classification process. As you all know, particularly in this area, follow-through is crucial. Implementation is essential. All the grand pronouncements and rhetoric will accomplish little if you don't have that kind of follow-through and clearly monitored implementation. A final priority for me, which certainly relates to the previous two, is issuing a revised version of Executive Order 12958 on classified national security information that corrects some mistakes of the past and perhaps even improves upon the Clinton administration original. One particular area where I hope we can figure out some way of enacting some real change is with regard to the problem that all of us recognize as a central problem of the security classification system, the essential problem, and that is that too much information gets classified in the first place. That also is, from my experience, far and away the most difficult problem to figure out how to solve. How to actually change in a meaningful way the practices that have existed for decades. I have some ideas about how we can do it. I think others here surely have some ideas. Pass them along if you have them. I think that's an area that we might have a chance to tackle in a meaningful way. And finally, despite my designated role as the Grinch here, I am reasonably confident that we can do these things that I have suggested within the first year of the new administration. But it'll take a lot of persistent effort both within and outside the administration if it's going to happen. Thanks.
Thank you. Optimistic Grinch, that's something quite new for us. Let's move on to Bill so we'll have some time for questions.
Well, thank you, and it is a genuine pleasure to be with you this afternoon. I'll try to keep my comments brief so we can get into a little bit more of a dialogue, but I've been asked to kind of build upon Bill Leary's comments in terms of giving a perspective in terms of what are some of the challenges of implementing a real change within the bureaucracy and whatever. And I want to make it perfectly clear, I've had over 30 years federal experience, and I loved it. I loved being a public servant. And so please don't take any of my comments to be somewhat of a downer or what have you, but it just really is intended to reflect a little bit about the reality which I've experienced over those 30 years. For example, my most recent job before I retired was, of course, as the director of the Information Security Oversight Office. And that's a position that is almost exclusively involved in the interagency process. And when I first got involved in it, I tended to regard the interagency process as a necessary evil. It didn't take me too long to really come to the conclusion that only one of those words was truly operative. And I'll let you figure out which one was operative between the necessary and the evil. But nonetheless, Bill is absolutely right, though, in terms of as cumbersome as the interagency process can be, there really is no alternative in terms of implementing some far-reaching and meaningful change unless you incorporate the internal government stakeholders into the process as well. The challenge is that, again, from my experience, is that all too often when agency representatives would show up at an interagency process meeting, they would characterize what I found to be one of the defining traits of Washington, and that is the single thing that distinguished bureaucrats such as I was from the tourists in this town. And the only thing that distinguishes a bureaucrat from a tourist is agency prerogative. And every single critical issue, somehow, some way, when it's approached, when it's attacked, or whatever, is reacted to from a perspective of, well, wait a minute. First and foremost, we have to make certain that this doesn't somehow, some way, undermine agency prerogatives or what have you. I never once in my career as an ISU director did I ever ask an agency or an agency official to do something which wasn't in their own interest, which wasn't in the interest of the mission of their organization. But yet, more often than not, the resistance I would run into would be not necessarily because that's a bad idea or a bad thing to do. It's, who the heck are you to tell me to do this? And it's just, again, I'm not necessarily telling you anything that you don't know, but it's just a phenomenon of the bureaucracy. And my experience has been is that the lower you are down in that bureaucracy, the types of people who engage in the working groups that tend to take place in these interagency processes, the more likely you are willing to fight and die and bleed in the street over this thing known as agency prerogative just for the sake of doing it without any real appreciation for the big picture. And invariably, this will happen when there is not, and it will happen in the absence of any clear articulation of top-down leadership, top-down expectations, top-down objectives, top-down means by which to measure progress, top-down means by which to hold people accountable and to actually provide for consequences. And quite frankly, in my tenure as director of ISOO over the past 5 years, there really wasn't a whole heck of a lot of that top-down guidance, that top-down leadership. Matter of fact, I knew that if any of the issues that I was dealing with ever got elevated up to the most senior levels, I would probably end up losing from the perspective that I thought was the right way to go. And so in many regards, I found myself trying to, prevent things from being elevated. For fear that that the wrong decision would come out. So it's amazing, you know, in terms of how much of our federal bureaucracy actually, again, in the absence of top-down guidance, how it operates on the objective of consensus. Absence any clear articulation, absence any clear metrics, absence any clear means by which to measure forward progress, almost anybody can say no. Almost anybody can throw in an objection. And again, absent the clear articulation of expectations from the highest of levels, nobody wants to go into the Oval Office and say, Mr. President, we can't fix this problem. We need you to fix it. You know, nobody wants to be in that position. So what ends up happening is that the individuals who can say no get almost a disproportionate power when you're operating in the spirit of consensus, because nobody wants to go in with that, it's a 12-3 vote type of thing, Mr. President, you have to decide and whatever. So it really does give a disproportionate amount of influence to the naysayers. It gives a disproportionate amount of influence to the people who want to say no. So really, in terms of the key to success, and that's why I, like everyone or most everyone else in this room, is so excited in terms of what we've seen even just after the first week. There is the beginnings of clear articulation from the most senior of level in terms of what those expectations are, what those objectives are, what it is that the expectation is that the bureaucracy will be working towards. But I think, as we all know, there's a key difference between aspiration and results. And it's one thing to write a memo. It's another thing in order to actually have real change come about because of the articulation of aspiration. So, some of the things that I would differ from with my colleague Bill, who I've worked with very closely for many years on just one key point. Bill articulated a need for patience. I would advocate just the opposite. We can't be patient. There has to be a demand for not only the most senior top-down articulation of objectives and goals and things along those lines, but there also has to be institutionalization of real measures, methods to assess progress towards those goals. you know, setting a suspense date, 120 days, that's fine, that's the beginning of it, but I can't tell you how many times, and it's not just the past administration, but, you know, how many times did JFK have to say for those missiles to get moved in Cuba? It's amazing how just, you know, you would think the president saying, I want this done by such and such a date would carry some weight, but it would always amaze me how quickly those types of suspenses could be sloughed off by the bureaucracy without any real consequences, without any real accountability. So, you know, my challenge, you know, would be that we don't have patience, that we expect that there is not only these clear articulation of objectives and goals, but some real metrics put in place in which to assess the performance of agencies. Obviously, those metrics have to be transparent in and of themselves and really available to everybody, to include even the policy developmental process. You know, granted, developmental policy at the earliest stages, you know, that can and should be an internal government process, but there's nothing to say that goals can't be established, you know, specific metrics, and not just, you know, let's set a goal of 120 days, 180 days, and let's close our eyes for the next 6 months and then open them up and see where we're at and see if we made it or not. There has to be meaningful methods of assessment that mark it along the way. And the last point I would make is, and I think Gary Stern, our luncheon speaker, made this point very clear, is that this town is full of good ideas. I mean, good ideas are—they grow like flowers in the springtime and whatever. The key difference, of course, between a good idea and effective government policy is budget. Unless you have a budget, you know, funding in which to back it up, it's just one more good idea. And I think we all have to recognize that we're in a period of extreme fiscal constraints. You know, agencies will be battling over scarcity, and so that probably more than anything else is going to be a true challenge that we'll have to overcome. But I appreciate it. Look forward to the discussion.
Thank you. Lydia, do you have any comments on, you've been very patient for three speakers and some questions. Do you have any comments? Well, and if any of you would like to ask questions, if you'll line up the mic, we can interrupt my questions with yours.
I just have one thought about the notion that was mentioned earlier about open government issues and how we've gotten a couple of early wins and we're now at the back of the line because everyone's so busy. I really think it's a false premise that open government is in one box and all these other issues are separately. I think open government and government accountability really are relevant to all the policies that we deal with. We saw in that very recently with the TARP and with the economic stimulus issue where we're looking at ways to make the information about what is going on in the Congress more available to the public. So I would just say for people who care about open government, you know, keep making those phone calls and sending those emails, even if people tell you they are busy. There are many opportunities for us to encourage openness and transparency. It may not always be on a FOIA bill or a particular issue that looks at the outset to be about open government, but we should really be vigilant and not be complacent and not say that we've checked that box off and we're willing to just let those issues sit idle for the next 4 years.
Yes, sir.
My name is Mike Levin. Mr. Leary, high up on your wish list is a rewrite of the executive order on classification of national security information so that we classify less information. The executive order provides that no information should be classified unless it can be demonstrated that its disclosure would do a degree of damage to the national security. How would you change that principle?
Well, that's why it's difficult. I agree. It's not easy because inexorably, at the end of the process, somebody has to make a judgment. Some individual has to make a considered judgment, which leaves room for varying interpretations. One way I think you could push people in the right direction is to significantly tighten the definitions, which are in the executive order, for what kinds of information are eligible for classification. There are specific categories of information enumerated in the executive order that are eligible for classification under the harm standard that you articulated. Now, if you could narrow those definitions or even eliminate some of them, some of those categories, narrow the definition of those categories, over time, I think you might have an impact on how much information gets classified.
Let me ask a follow-up question. Sure. In that case. Is it possible, then, that it isn't the wording of the executive order relative to classification, but its effective management that maybe needs improvement and executive attention that needs improvement?
Well, the latter is certainly needed. That's one of the things I was referring to in part by saying that another of my high priorities is ensuring that the Information Security Oversight Office, which provides the oversight broadly for the national security community, has the resources and authorities that it needs to provide that kind of effective oversight.
If I could just follow up on that, I would just agree with you wholeheartedly in terms of, to me, the best leadership is by example. And one of the problems that we've seen, I think, in the last administration is where officials at the most senior level in the government use classification for purposes other than which it was intended. That is to deny it from those individuals who would use it to harm our nation. That sends a terrible example for the rest of the government to emulate, and would be foolish if we didn't think that the 3 million people with clearances are aware of that. That same kind of leadership by example could be used for the opposite purpose as well, to increase openness.
Let me follow up on Bill Leonard's earlier comment, which I was really struck with, and perhaps it's also relevant as a predicate to filling out forms and declaring priorities. And Lydia, you might have some comments on this because your boss also serves on the Appropriations Committee, and that is the issue of resources. A lot of us have a lot of priorities in not just the freedom of information area, but in many areas. Most of them require some additional resources. And so I think when we think about priorities in the real world, you know, being pragmatic about it, maybe some of the things that we'd rather have higher on the list ought to be put on a side or back burner until we can be more assured of resources and focus on lower hanging fruit that don't require so much financial investment. Is that off target?
No, that's absolutely right, and that certainly has been one of the challenges we've had in Congress in trying to get some of the good government initiatives actually implemented by the government, because there have not been the resources. Being on the Appropriations Committee certainly is a great advantage, because you are certainly in a position to help make those things happen. But I think also, again, as I mentioned earlier, also looking for opportunities in other ways to try to promote an open government agenda. It may not be, again, that you're looking for resources for the Office of Government Information Services, for example, which is very important, but perhaps in the context of some other legislation or some other issue, as agencies are starting to put their proposals together, we can look for ways to implement open government initiatives. So, obviously, those that don't require money are the ones that most people want to hear about, but even when there are ones that do require resources, try to look at opportunities where there already are commitments from the government to staff up offices or to devote new resources to the government.
If I could just make a follow-on point to that as a perfect example. Bill Leary mentioned priority of establishing a national declassification center. Again, this is just my personal opinion, but I firmly believe that the taxpayers of this country already spend enough on declassification of records. We don't spend it very smartly, but we spend a heck of a lot of money. And I think something like the National Declassification Center, by identifying and reallocating those resources that are currently used executive branch-wide, could go a long way to increasing efficiency, increasing effectiveness, reducing errors from both perspectives, stuff getting out that shouldn't get out, stuff being withheld that shouldn't be withheld, all without, increasing the burden on the taxpayer. It will obviously impact people's boxes, and that's sometimes even tougher to do.
That's the purpose.
But there are ways to do that without writing a new check.
Yes, sir. Last question.
Leo Massiana. My question goes to Bill Leary and Mr. Leonard, and it concerns ISOO's effectiveness and its placement as an organization. It was once part of OMB, and in terms of its resources and authority, and I would add access, is it as effective reporting to NARA and being placed in NARA as it should be?
Good question.
Well, Bill is the expert on this, but I'll give him time to compose his answer by volunteering my view. ISOO was never comfortable being a part of OMB. It looks good on paper, but it didn't work in practice. And the then director of ISOO, Steve Garfinkel, couldn't wait to get moved somewhere else. And that was during the Clinton administration, which was the most pro-disclosure in, administration in history until now. I was initially a skeptic about moving ISOO to the National Archives, perhaps for the reasons that you're hinting at now, Leo, that the National Archives doesn't have a whole lot of clout interagency. But I think it's worked quite well, much better than I imagined that it would work, because ISOO is in a place where they get meaningful support from the top of the agency, of the National Archives. And they've gotten many more resources than they once got in other parts of government, which weren't particularly happy to have them. So I think it's in the right place, unless somebody can convince me there's a better place.
No, I would agree with what Bill says. I mean, from my personal experience, I got nothing but the best support from the leadership in the National Archives. And I think we were able to be as effective there as we could be anywhere else, and maybe even more so, because not for the same reasons people look to NARA for a place to put OGIS and put the CUI as being impartial, objective, and whatever. Those are good reasons for ISOO as well. The only point I would make, though, is that you could increase ISOO to 1,000, program analysts rather than the 18 that we had, and it still isn't going to make much of a difference unless, in the absence of that senior commitment, not only from the most senior level in the administration, but from the agency heads as well too. That's where the real change will take place. So just like we saw in the Clinton administration, the impact that a Secretary Leary had on the Department of Energy, that's really where a wholesale change can occur, when you get that kind of emphasis from that kind of level on this particular topic.
And now the very last question. Yes, ma'am. Would you come to the microphone, please?
Question for Bill Leary or anyone else who cares to answer it, concerning national security. It took the Clinton administration a couple of years to issue an executive order regarding national security. And do you think this administration can do it quicker?
I think I'm hopeful. I have no real tangible evidence
to answer that question authoritatively. I'm hopeful, in part because I think the Clinton executive order established the basic standard, certainly with regard to declassification. It's always possible to tinker with it, improve it slightly here, there, elsewhere. But I also think that the Bush executive order, by not changing the key provisions of the Clinton order, that is preserving automatic declassification and the appeal mechanism of ICECAP, to some extent codified or the Clinton order, made it standard operating procedure throughout the classification, declassification community. Therefore, I think a new direction, a change, which I'm sure will be wanted, can be achieved without starting all over. Correcting or changing some of the changes that were made in the Bush order, which I certainly would favor, and doing a few other things, perhaps.
Well, that's helpful. Thank you.
And if I could just follow up, from the point of view, can it? There's nothing that, from a metaphysical perspective, that says no. So it's all a question of will. And that process I described before about anyone at a working group level saying no and slowing down the process, that's how it takes 3 years. And as long as it's made very clear from the very beginning that that will not be tolerated, that these are the goals and the objectives, this is what we have to strive for, this is the due out date, you will be held accountable, then the answer is very clearly yes, we can.
Well, that's a great note to end on. Thank you very much, panelists, for your contributions. I appreciate everything that each of you has done in the name of openness. And now I turn the microphone back to our master of ceremonies, our ringleader, the inimitable Dan Metcalf.
Leader of the ring, yes.